This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. The number 46 becomes a rallying cry this summer as state lawmakers put the finishing touches on the budget. That's because North Carolina ranks 46th in what it pays teachers. Many people, including the state school superintendent, argued good teachers would leave the profession or go to neighboring states that pay more if North Carolina didn't raise teacher salaries. But lawmakers were not swayed. Lisa Miller set out to see if those fears are warranted.
5 years ago, North Carolina was ranked 25th in the nation for average teacher pay. That put it well above neighboring states. Then the recession hit. There were cutbacks, and teacher pay pretty much stagnated. Now the state is ranked 46th with an average teacher pay of $46,000. But how does this ranking affect North Carolina's ability to hold on to good teachers and recruit new ones?
It's a bad question.
That's Dan Goldhaber. He's a professor at the University of Washington, and he spends a lot of time studying the effects of teacher pay.
You need to look at what salary is at different points in a teacher's career and compare that to what people could make at different points in their career teaching in other states and or at different points in a career in a non-teaching occupation.
Okay, point taken. So let's start with beginning pay for a teacher in North Carolina. The state sets the minimum at $30,800, although most districts supplement salaries. South Carolina and Tennessee are comparable. Salaries in Virginia districts neighboring North Carolina pretty much begin in the mid-30s. Like most states, North Carolina uses a teacher pay scale based on years of experience. To navigate that, we'll get some help from someone who knows it well.
I'm Alexis Schaus. I'm the director of school business at the Department of Public Instruction.
North Carolina teachers used to get significant bumps in their salary after the third year to encourage them to stay once they had the hang of teaching. But for the past 5 years, teacher salaries have largely remained frozen, save for a 1% across-the-board pay hike.
So a teacher straight out of college with a bachelor's degree makes $30,800, and the teacher with 5 years of experience and really very proficient at their job also makes that same amount.
And if the General Assembly decided to end the salary freeze?
It takes 15 years to reach $40,000. And it takes 36 years to reach the top of the earning scale of $52,000.
Factor in lawmakers' decision to eliminate tenure and an automatic pay raise for master's degrees, and neighboring states start looking more appealing. Other professions, too. But are teachers actually leaving to teach in other states or to take jobs out of the profession? Well, you hear of a teacher here and there leaving, but you also hear concerns from many teachers like Andrew Shimko. He's in his second year at Independence High School in Charlotte. Shimko got a jump start on that $40,000 salary. He makes close to that thanks to a $5,000 CMS supplement, one of the highest in the state, and an extra bump for getting his teaching certificate this year. He got that sooner than most teachers since he's part of an alternate entry program. Shimko says he's lucky because that makes him one of only a few teachers to get a pay raise.
I've got a lot of friends. We're all young teachers. We all love what we do, but it's hard to scrape by when it's every bill you pay, you're having to worry about how you're going to pay it, especially when there are other jobs out there.
The state surveys teachers who leave their jobs, but there's no specific question about whether it's due to salary. Instead, you can look at responses like dissatisfied with teaching or career change. The latest data is from 2012. The number of teachers leaving the profession more than doubled to 816 teachers compared to 2010. The number of teachers leaving to teach in other states pretty much held constant during that time. Shao says it's hard to draw conclusions from that. What's striking to her is a significant decrease in the number of North Carolina teachers with 1 to 6 years of experience and more than 25.
So we're seeing over 5,000 less teachers in those beginning years and over 3,000 less teachers in the older years. The impact this is going to have is in 5 years from now when we don't have those experienced teachers in the middle.
Some of that could be districts hiring fewer teachers due to tighter budgets. But Chow says it also shows North Carolina is having a harder time holding on to teachers and attracting new ones. The worry is, down the line, the state could be coping with teacher shortages. But back to that number 46. You may soon be hearing chants of 47 or 48, since most teacher salaries will likely stay the same, Lawmakers responded to pay concerns, giving districts the authority next year to offer up to 25% of teachers 4-year contracts. They would include $500 raises each year. It represents a move toward a pay structure based on merit. Many people, including Shouse, see it as a necessary shift to attract and keep good teachers. But she says none of that matters if lawmakers aren't willing to fund higher salaries in the first place. I'm Lisa Miller.
It's the end of summer, vacations are over, and we enter into one of the best seasons for fishing along our coast, thanks to cooler temperatures. But as you plan your fall fishing trip, make sure your recreational fishing license is up to date. Since 2007, anglers have been required to pay $5 to $30 for a recreational fishing license. Although most fishermen are reluctant to pay, the money generated through the sale of these licenses supports local fisheries and projects that provide water access and education. The fishing license requirement was established as a result of 2005 legislation that aimed at enhancing marine resources in the state. The Coastal Recreational Fishing License Program Coordinator is Beth Cavani.
An average of about $5.5 million is generated through the sale of the coastal fishing licenses.
Each year, a portion of the license fee goes to fund projects to manage, restore, protect, develop, and enhance marine resources. This fiscal year, about 44% of the overall sale of the fishing license was used to fund the grants. According to the North Carolina Division of Marine Fisheries website, nearly $10 million in grant money has been awarded in the last 5 years. Dr. Joel Faudry, the Assistant Professor of Fisheries at the Institute of Marine Sciences, has received about $400,000 for 2 grants focusing on habitat studies.
Our lab tries to connect fish populations to habitat. I think we all have a general appreciation that habitat is valuable. But beyond that, we really struggle to quantitatively say this much habitat equals this much fish production.
Faudry says the goal of the study is to determine what types of habitat are conducive to supporting healthy fisheries. The way they collect their data is by tagging different species of fish.
These are tags that we surgically implant inside fish, and we've worked with red drum, black drum, sheephead. And once the tag is inside the fish, it sends out a ping, ping, ping. And we have these listening stations that we place around the sounds and around habitat. And if a fish comes close to that listening station, it's registered that the fish was in the area. And not only that a fish was in the area, but that fish.
The information is gathered and posted on their website, where anglers can see the movements and behaviors of a particular fish species.
These tracks that we map and play videos of essentially sort of make the fish not invisible, so that you can see where they're at in the time of any given time of the day or where you can see where they're at seasonally within an estuary, like the New River.
You can find a link to those maps at our website, publicradioeast.org. Faudry's project is being funded through the end of 2015. Another study, conducted by North Carolina State University grad student Tim Ellis, focused on tagging spotted sea trout. The project started in 2009 when spotted sea trout was overfished.
Most of our fish that we tagged were caught hook and line, utilizing the help of recreational fishing guides across the state, and we would mark these fish with an external tag, and it would have a phone number and a tag number on it, and then we'd release those fish and essentially rely on the fishery or fishermen to call in any tag fish that they catch and give us that tag number and some other information about the fish, like where they caught it and the length of it and things like that.
Ellis says they were primarily interested in the movement and the mortality of spotted sea trout, two important aspects of the local fishery that are poorly known.
With mortality in particular, we're interested in separating that out into its fishing and natural components. So fishing mortality is essentially what it sounds like, harvest and catch and release mortality, anything associated with fishing practices. And then natural mortality is everything else, so predation or disease or old age or bad water quality, all the natural causes of death. And so we used our tagging data to model and create estimates of that fishing and natural mortality.
The information on spotted sea trout movement and mortality will be used in future stock assessments, as well as to compare natural and fishing mortalities in hopes of preventing overfishing. Other projects funded by the recreational fishing license fees focus on monitoring water quality. In 1999, a program called Ferrymon was initiated. Dr. Hans Perl, Keenan Professor at the Institute of Marine Sciences, says ferries that cross the Pamlico Sound are fitted with instruments that measure basic water quality parameters.
Water taken in by the ferries to cool their air conditioning system, diverted through a black box below deck, has a set of sensors in it that are constantly monitoring things like temperature, pH, salinity of the water, algae content. The data from those sensors automatically gets sent back to our laboratories by the internet.
The data is charted so officials with the Division of Water Quality and Division of Marine Fisheries can monitor real-time the water quality in the Pamlico Sound. If an issue is detected, a lab technician has the ability to remotely take a water sample that can be thoroughly analyzed later. The North Carolina Department of Transportation-based Ferrymon program did not receive any funding from the state this fiscal year. Rather, $143,000 from the recreational fishing license will keep the Ferrymon program going for another 2 years.
First of all, the Pamlico Sound is the second largest estuary in the country. It's the most important fisheries nursery along the East Coast. And equally important, Ferrymon is the only monitoring program that we have for water quality on that system. So it's really important to keep it alive and keep it working for the state.
A total of 20 grant proposals were awarded funds from the recreational fishing license this fiscal year. $650,000 was allocated for the construction of a boating and fishing access in Onslow County, and a multi-year grant was issued to purchase property to build a boating access area in Vandermeer. For Public Radio East, I'm Jared Brumbaugh. The Downeast Journal is made possible by our members in partnership with the Schechter Foundation of Kinston. This is PRE Public Radio East. As summer winds down, you may be thinking your gardening season is coming to an end, but you'd be wrong. During this week's Garden Journal, Ann Edwards offers some tips on growing a fall vegetable garden.
Right now is actually the beginning of the best time of year for vegetable gardening in coastal North Carolina. No, I'm not kidding. Fall gardening is absolutely spectacular here. You'll be planting vegetables that you harvest for Thanksgiving and Christmas dinner, and some, believe it or not, that you will be harvesting next February or maybe March, about the time you would usually start planting most of your spring vegetables. So get ready, it's fall gardening time, and I really want you to participate this year. If your garden is already prepared, if you have your space selected and your bed ready, and you simply need to clean up from the summer, well, go do it. Make sure you take out every bit of leaf litter and root, everything you can from the summer plants, because if they're like mine, right now, they're eaten up with diseases and insects, and you just want them out of your garden. With vegetable plants, it's usually best not to put those into your compost pile, particularly if you don't take really good care to make sure your compost heats up. You don't want to spread diseases back into the soil. Once you've pulled up all the old vines, taken out the old leaves, and you have a fresh new slate to begin with, what should you be planting? Well, carrot seeds can already be in the ground. And starting any time now, you can plant your beet seeds. And kohlrabi, mustard greens, rutabagas, spinach, all sorts of things that you plant from seed can go in the ground right now. Soon, within about 2 weeks, it'll be a great time to start putting transplants in the ground. Yes, those plants that are going to go in as transplants. Think in terms of your cabbage and kale, collards and broccoli. A lot of people transplant those. Well, the greenhouses on the coast already have them growing, and they are beautiful. And depending on what the weather does within the next couple weeks, any time could be the best time to put them in the ground. Every year, well, it's a little experiment to figure out what's exactly right. It's been really hot the last few weeks, so I'll probably wait until a little closer to September 1st before I put transplants in the ground. But they're out there, and they're ready for you. So go and get them. And the best plant for the fall, one that can only be planted in the fall here, garlic. About September 15th through the end of October, depending on the year, is when you put garlic in the ground, and then you harvest it, well, sometime around mid-June. There is nothing better, in my opinion, than harvesting beautiful, fresh garlic from the garden. I have two huge braids in my kitchen from this year that I will use all winter long. But you can only grow it here if you plant it in the fall. If you want to know exactly which plants to grow in the fall here on coastal North Carolina, go to my county extension website, carteret.ces.ncsu.edu. That stands for Cooperative Extension Service, North Carolina State University, and then EDU for education. Go to the Lawn and Garden page and scroll down to the Growing Food in Coastal Carolina, and you'll find the month-by-month calendar there. It will tell you what to plant in which month. One more thing, for those of you who thought you were about finished with beautiful fresh vegetables from local farms, that's not true either. Although we're in a bit of a lull right now between the midsummer plants and the first crops to harvest in late summer, there's still sweet corn getting ready to come off. And our farmers now plant sweet corn every few weeks, so there's likely to be fresh corn being picked for the next couple of months. Keep going to your farm stands or to your farmer's market and look for fresh vegetables. Maybe when you were a kid, they were only available for a few weeks, but some of your favorites are going to be available much longer. And then when the last of that late sweet corn is gone, well, they'll start harvesting spinach and lettuce and kale and collards and broccoli, the same things that I talked about earlier that you can plant in your own garden. So get out there, get ready for fall planting, and keep going out and seeing what your local farmers have available. And I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.
Ocracoke Island is a favorite summertime getaway in eastern North Carolina. That was true back in the 1950s, as it attracted some notables to its relatively isolation. Among them was Dear Wright, a noted children's author from the 1950s into the early 1980s. She released 19 children's books in a 25-year period, including the 1957 New York Times bestseller, The Lonely Doll. Her one book for adults paid tribute to the history and people of Ocracoke Island, but never got published until 50 years after she put it together, and well after the author had passed. George Olson has this, which originally aired in July of 2006.
In 1957, Dare Wright broke into the consciousness of American readers with a popular children's book, The Lonely Doll, which she followed up with 18 more pieces of children's literature before she died in 2001.
I have described her as sometimes not of this world, an ethereal sprite. She had a childlike nature, not childlike in that she was not intelligent, but she always kept the childlike wonderment that disappears from the rest of us at an early age. And she always had a belief that people were good. She trusted people, just like a child would. And most of the time that was repaid, and it was certainly repaid in Ocracoke.
Wright was introduced to Ocracoke Island in the early 1950s by a friend, Donald Sewell, now 94 and living in Chapel Hill. Wright visited the island regularly for 30 years and even included photos of Ocracoke in a follow-up to The Lonely Doll called Holiday for Edith and the Bears. But another tribute to the island laid, for the most part, unseen for many years.
I wasn't aware that the manuscript existed of Ocracoke in the 50s until I was going through Dare's belongings after her death. I was her legal guardian and her heir, and I came across this single-bound volume that she'd done, and it had been in the form of a mock-up or a dummy that would be presented to a publisher. She'd taken the photographs, she'd worked on the prints, and then she typed and pasted in the narrative under the photographs, the same way she had done with her children's book. So it was almost ready to be shown to a publisher, but since it had been sitting for 40 years, the prints needed restoration, and my husband, John Ogilvy, restored the photographs, and we edited some of the text, but it's essentially the very same volume that Dare created and then put aside for 40-plus years.
Brooke Ashley, who with John Ogilvy edited the manuscript and photos that Dare Wright left behind and finally got them published in an edition by John Blair Publishing of Winston-Salem. The book, while intended for adult readership, in some ways is like her children's books, long on photography, short on text, though the text, written nearly 50 years ago and viewed in that context, now appears very forward-thinking.
Islanders have always had to cope with a multitude of chores. The people of Ocracoke built their own boats and houses. Much of their lumber, oak and mahogany, cedar and teak, was salvaged from wrecks. Today, more ordinary lumber is imported from the mainland. Life was simple on Ocracoke. Neighbor helped neighbor, and everyone lent a hand on community projects. There was no crime. Where would a criminal hide? No one ever locked a door. But with the stream of strangers now passing through, some are beginning to rethink the need. The old ways are changing. The speech is changing. Square dancing has ended. When I was on Ocracoke this week, that's one of the things that people of Ocracoke were talking about, how there's nothing patronizing in this book. There isn't any of the flavor, oh, aren't these people quaint? Listen to their quaint colloquialisms. Rather, that she really appreciated the people for what they were. And the other thing that I was talking about with people who lived on Ocracoke was how prescient Dare was, not only that some of the customs were changing, that the speech patterns were changing, but that so much was beginning to be lost, so much of the old customs, and that there were real ecological changes that were occurring. And that's not something someone in the 1950s really thought about. So Dare really was ahead of the curve on that.
Days before our talk, Brooke Ashley returned to Ocracoke for the first time in nearly 50 years. Her father is Donald Sewell, the man who introduced Dare Wright to Ocracoke. Her return found many of the people photographed by Dare still part of the island's population.
There's a wonderful picture of a young girl named Sherry O'Neill, and I love Dare's text. She says, Sherry O'Neill, a woman with the face of an 18th century sailing lad, makes her living shrimping and floundering. And Sherry came to the book signing on Ocracoke, and she wanted to come specifically to say how much Dare had meant to her, how much knowing Dare had meant to her, and even went to New York to see Dare one time. So Dare made an incredible impression on people who lived on Ocracoke in the same way they made the impression on her.
Sherry O'Neill was working two jobs at the time she met Dare, a fisherwoman who also worked at the local motel, much as most of the islanders work multiple jobs in the isolated environment. So it's not too surprising that Dare Wright, author, fashion photographer, and model, made a lasting impression on Ocracoke.
The photograph is of Dare, who was strikingly tall, slender, tanned, blonde, beautiful, and people kept saying yesterday how she would walk down the streets in Ocracoke and people would just stop and stare. And there she is on top of a pile of timbers with a little striped t-shirt, white capri pants, looking almost as if someone had posed a Barbie doll on top of some driftwood. It is a striking contrast.
The shot, apparently taken with a timer, has Dare posed on top of wreckage from the Carol A. Deering, the ghost ship of Diamond Shoals, the famous, still unexplained shipwreck of 1921. As Brooke just said, it is in fact a striking contrast, but if her physical appearance separated her from the island's natives, they still shared a common bond underneath.
The honesty of the people who did not have a New York pretentious attitude, which is where Dare lived when she wasn't visiting Ocracoke, must have been enormously appealing. People on Ocracoke are charming, they're witty, and they say what they mean. There's no side to them the way there was no side to Dare. So I think she felt very much at home among the people of Ocracoke, and in turn, they welcomed her. The love and affection that people have been telling me they feel and that their parents and grandparents felt for Dare is really quite amazing, because she was a very exotic creature to be plopped down on this little island. But it worked. It worked for her and it worked for them. And I think that's why this story, this book, Ocracoke in the 50s, is timeless.
Brooke Ashley, who with John Ogilvy edited Ocracoke in the 50s, Photographs and Narrative by Dare Wright. The book is published by John Blair. I'm George Olson.
Thanks for listening to the Down East Journal this week. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features, you can drop us a line at publicradioeast.org. Have a great Labor Day weekend.